mental illness is so prevalent in our population, and more recently there's been so much more of a focus on it, but yet there is not a whole lot of published work that's out there that is looking at these disparities and looking into this really important patient population.
Welcome to the Cold Steel Surgical Podcast with your hosts Amir Farouk and Chad Ball. We've had the absolute privilege of chatting with some amazing Canadian as well as international guests over the past year. While the topics have been broad in range, whether clinical, social, or political, our aims for the podcast continue to remain the same. We hope to inspire discussion, creativity, scholarly research, and career development in all Canadian surgeons. We hope you enjoy our second season as we continue to highlight some incredible guests, deliver detailed masterclass sessions on a myriad of clinical topics, and introduce some fresh new features such as debate and companion formats. We hope you relish the podcast as much as we do.
With all the recent attention to inequities in the surgical community and beyond, sometimes the invisible disparities go unnoticed. Mental health and its impact on surgical outcomes has been relatively poorly studied, and so on today's episode, we invited the authors of a new narrative review on the topic to talk about what they found. The title of the paper is Improving Surgical Quality for Patients with Mental Health Illness, a Narrative Review, and was published this August in 2021 in Annals of Surgery. Dr. Rebecca Afford, Dr. J.J. Sidhu, and Dr. Murad Hamid joined Dr. Ball and I to discuss mental health and its impact on surgical outcomes. We would love to hear your thoughts. What does your institution do to better manage surgical patients with concomitant mental health disease? Email us at podcast.cgs@gmail.com or on Twitter at CanJSurge.
Well, we're so excited to have three really, really interesting guests on Cold Steel today. Thank you to each of you for joining us. I think we're going to talk about a really important topic here. Before we do that, though, I would love it if Rebecca, followed by JJ, and then, of course, friends and listeners to the show know Murad Hamid very well. I was wondering if you could introduce yourself and just sort of give us your career path and how you ended up in BC.
I'll get started. I'm Rebecca. I'm currently an R2 in the general surgery program at UBC. I did my undergraduate training at Queen's University. After growing up in Nelson, British Columbia, I took a year off actually after my undergraduate degree, and I lived in Australia. But afterwards, I was accepted into UBC for medical school, and I did my training in the Northern Medical Program in Prince George.
And I'm J.J. Sidhu. I'm a psychiatrist, a consult liaison psychiatrist here at Vancouver General Hospital, which means I mainly work on the medical and surgical units. I'm also the department head for psychiatry with Vancouver Acute and Community, and the medical director for mental health and substance use here at Vancouver Acute, Tertiary, and Urgent Services.
Hey, Chad and Amir, it's Murad Hamid. I am a trauma surgeon intensivist at the Vancouver General Hospital, and I'm the head of the Division of General Surgery at VGH and at the University of British Columbia. And just wanted to say how thrilled I am to be with you both and with this team. Thank you for having us.
Well, as always, we're always delighted to have you on the show, and our listeners love having you on the show, and we're so delighted to have J.J. Sidhu and, of course, the illustrious Rebecca Afford on the podcast with us. And we really have a great topic lined up for us today. And we're going to center our discussion mostly around a paper that's published in the Annals of Surgery. Rebecca, you're the lead author on this paper, and congratulations again for all the hard work that you put into this and for getting this published and accepted to Annals. What is exactly interested you in this topic, and why did you get into this?
I just like to start out by thanking everybody who is co-authors with me. This wouldn't have been possible without them. And I'm really excited for this paper to undergo publication. In terms of the title of the paper, it's called Improving Surgical Quality for Patients with Mental Illness, a Narrative Review. And what it is, it's a systematic review looking at patients with mental illness and their surgical outcomes and how that compares to their counterparts who undergo the same surgeries but do not have mental illness and the disparities in their care. How I got interested in this topic, I think started predominantly when I was on trauma, and that was my very first rotation of residency. But what I started to notice on trauma is that some people presented to the trauma bay, if they had a pediatric illness, sometimes when they rolled into our trauma bay, that was their first presentation of their mental illness. And unfortunately, it ended in a trauma that we would manage. And the other part of that was also in seeing firsthand their post-operative care and just anecdotally seeing that these patients staying a little bit longer in hospital with post-operative complications, and I really didn't understand why.
That's a great story, Rebecca. And I think we all know that, you know, research projects that come to fruition and are published in targets like Annals of Surgery usually start, you know, the seed of them is usually something that we see that's clinically interesting or unexplained on the ward or in the operating theater or in the hospital in general. So that's great. I'm going to focus you a little bit here and ask you some specific questions. So one of the interesting things about this review is that it's a narrative review rather than a systematic review. And I think, you know, certainly Morad and I have published a lot of those, and I'm sure JJ has too. Can you explain to our listeners maybe the difference? What makes this a narrative review as opposed to a more traditional either meta-analysis or systematic review?
Yes. So what we did with this paper was do the classic review in looking through the big databases like Ovid and Medline and the Cochrane review files. And we ended up pulling those papers and looking through abstracts like you would in a systematic review. But from those papers, what we ended up doing was looking for underlying themes and recurrent trends that kept coming up with the papers.
What were some of the holes in the methodology or some of the concerns you had, you know, that you described in your manuscript?
So in terms of things that we found that were holes was overall, we were only able to find 19 papers that gave us a good idea or that had a good look at comparing surgical outcomes between patients with mental illness and patients who did not. So mental illness is so prevalent in our population. And more recently, there's been so much more of a focus on it. But yet there is not a whole lot of published work that's out there that is looking at these disparities and looking into this really important patient population. I think that would be the largest thing that we found. Another thing that we found is a lot of the papers that are out there are looking at specific cohorts, such as bariatric surgery, where psychiatric care is a big part of their surgical process in terms of preoperative planning and postoperative counseling. But that wasn't exactly the patient population that we were looking for and that we were targeting with our definition of mental illness.
Yeah, that's well stated. JJ, can we ask you, what's your sense over a longer period of time, maybe than Rebecca's been involved in this topic, as to why there is such a paucity of sort of well-described studies, and I would suggest maybe even study in general in the overlap between surgical care and mental illness?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And in my particular area in psychiatry, it's a challenge in itself. We're often looking for papers that describe the patient in front of us, where we have a medical or a surgical condition and a mental health condition that are interfacing. But when you look at the papers, many of the studies exclude patients that are unwell, if they're looking from a physical health standpoint, if they're looking primarily at a mental health outcome. They'll exclude those patients that have that are over the age of 65. So that's it. Does it, the group of or the patient population that we're often seeing in hospital is not what historically researchers have been examining. So much of what we're seeing in terms of the literature is pioneering, probably related to that reason. I think as mental health is now becoming more of a discussion point in the media, in society at large, and within healthcare, people are asking these questions. So my hope is that we're going to be seeing more of these papers.
Yeah, it's such an interesting and rich area of study. And I think you find a lot of benefit from actually studying the intersection of two different fields. And in some ways, it's kind of surprising that this hasn't been done more. And one of the things that I thought super interesting from the study was that the outcomes were quite dramatic for in terms of the differences between patients with mental illness versus those that didn't in terms of surgical outcomes. You know, to quote one data point from the paper, we talk about the fact that the incidence of perforation in appendicitis with patients who had schizophrenia was 53% to 66% of patients with mental illness, compared to 17% to 30% in controls in one included study. And the review highlights so many different ways in which surgical care and surgical outcomes continues to be a problem for patients with mental illness. And I think we're unique to have you on this team as someone who gets to straddle both those worlds and is involved in both of those sides of that equation. So can you break this down for us a little bit? Is this a provider problem that we don't know how to deal with patient illness, or is this a patient problem where patients don't have access to care, or a bit of both? Can you break that down for us a little bit more, JJ?
Yeah, great question. And it's probably multifactorial is my sense. You know, if I probably look at it more from a patient perspective, a provider perspective, and a social or a systemic level. At a patient level, certainly there are inherent aspects of the individual's condition or symptomatology that might be making access to care an issue. Patients might present with anxiety or even paranoia that could really make an examination of a patient difficult. Many individuals who suffer from mental illness have had trauma through the system, through the healthcare system. And that speaks into some of the stigma or the structural stigma that's embedded within healthcare. There's also issues with lack of insight in some particular cases associated with certain conditions that also make presenting to their medical providers an issue. On a provider level, that's something that might manifest in the form of underestimating risk associated with mental illness and surgical outcomes. If somebody's stable with depression or schizophrenia or appears to be, and they're coming in for an appendectomy or some sort of surgery, we might say to ourselves that, okay, maybe there's not a lot of risk, whereas there's potential for some of these medications complicating post-operative periods and whatnot. So those are things to take into consideration. Lack of screening for mental illness, and that's fairly that's a pretty common thing, I think, in healthcare. Like the way that we're set up, we're somewhat siloed. So, you know, people, understandably so, people are coming in for surgery. We're really focused on the task at hand, and sometimes or often we're not considering things like mental illness or depression or some of those other aspects. It might be on the chart, but in terms of how we're managing it in front of us, it might not be a priority in the moment. At a systems level, we have issues. We have people with mental illness struggle with many of the or have struggled with a lot of the issues with social determinants of health, such as poverty or higher rates of poverty, higher rates of housing security insecurity, even food insecurity, people with chronic mental psychotic illnesses. You might find them in regions that are where it's challenging to access healthcare as well. So there's a whole host of issues that I think make it make access to care a challenge. You know, interestingly, bariatric surgery was not included as a population in this particular paper. I was connected to a bariatric outpatient clinic here in the Vancouver region, and I did a lot of screening of folks that were considering that, considering those related surgeries, and I was blown away by the amount of depression, the amount of trauma, past history of sexual abuse in that population. So, and certainly this impacted outcomes. We know that people with depression are less likely to be compliant with all forms of medical treatment. So there's an association there. People who have had that type of trauma also, you know, might follow up might be difficult interfacing with their care providers post-operatively. So some people get lost to follow up. So some of the inherent challenges, I think.
You know, there's so many great things in what you just said that we could potentially unpack, but I want to drill down if you have time on a couple of them. You know, from a simple sort of surgical brain like mine, intuitively it seems clear that the reason that, for example, perforations with a bowel obstruction or appendicitis, for example, would be more common in patients with mental illness seems to be related to a lot of the issues you talked about, delay in presentation, delay in care, and so on. But the equivalent part of it that really is interesting to me is the back end component. So to look at these patients in terms of hospital acquired issues, whether that's, you know, overall sepsis rates, infection rates, acute kidney injury, ICU admission rates. I mean, Rebecca's list is quite long in terms of them having poor outcomes. I'm curious what, you know, when the rubber meets the road in the hospital, why you think that truly does happen. And then potentially some of the things that, you know, we're clearly missing as a surgical or medical or post-operative care a team.
I think when people are coming into hospital they're and have a history of mental illness, the literature does show that and I think we mentioned it even in this study, that people are less likely to order diagnostic tests. Patients are less likely to get certain interventions. One, why that happens, it's one could speculate, but it probably relates to, in part, some of that stigma that we see toward mental health clients. It also speaks to some of those challenges that I mentioned around examining the patient. The conditions themselves have an inherent, there's been some inherent differences. For example, schizophrenia, we know that glucose metabolism is somewhat different. There's some changes there. Inflammation and wound healing is different in patients suffering from significant mental illness. There's also associations with multiple medical different conditions have higher rates of mental illness. And we'll see that in neurological conditions, in arthritis, in diabetes, cancer. So you're more likely to have depression or anxiety. And we can understand that. We understand that, that makes a lot of sense, just a lot of face validity there. Comorbid substance use, that makes it challenging in terms of One, the management of patients who are in hospital. They might be struggling with addictions issues, withdrawal aspects, adherence to care, and then the medication side effects. So the medications that we prescribe, especially in psychotic illnesses, can be pretty heavy duty. They come with a whole host of side effects, including metabolic disturbance. You'll see potentially increased risk of aspiration, cardiac arrhythmias, increased levels of potential for decrease in seizure threshold. So all these aspects could potentially contribute to a worse outcome in hospital.
You know, one of the things that Amir and I were really excited to ask you specifically is, I think on the trauma side of things, the injury side, the injury services, we work with our psychiatric colleagues very, very closely. I can't think of a day where we don't have a psychiatrist, for example, at the Foothills Hospital wandering by the trauma ward. They're always involved, as you point out, in a large percentage of our patients. But I'm not sure, in really thinking about, you know, the work Rebecca has done, that we do as good a job for the emergency general surgery or access services. And from there, I could take it even beyond that to, as you would guess, orthopedic surgery, for example, plastic surgery, a whole bunch of inpatient, you know, general hospital services. I'm curious what your bias is in terms of sort of when you like to be called, who you like to be called about, and how you view that interaction with surgical services in general. My bias is that we're probably underutilizing and under consulting our mental health experts like yourself.
Yeah, fair enough. I joke. I say surgeons, or most surgeons that I've met, would make excellent psychiatrists. You know, you deal with scenarios where people are really facing some of the worst circumstances in their lives. And the amount of compassion that I've seen from the surgeons that I work with and the surgical residents speaks, it's quite impressive. And the in terms of the question around consultation, under consulting and whatnot, that's an interesting question. You know, larger institutions will have psychiatry or services that will, or consultation liaison services like we do here at Vancouver General Hospital. You might not have that at smaller centers. So this concept of resource scarcity, and you could, you know, maybe you don't want to overburden a consultation service. There might be that feeling or perspective. There might be that, it might also feed into that under recognition of illness, or the feeling that a stable psychiatric condition doesn't warrant calling a psychiatrist. But you know, there are scenarios where I think even in a situation where we have a quote unquote stable individual, that it might be worthwhile getting someone like myself involved. A concrete example would be perhaps a patient who has schizophrenia and is on the antipsychotic clozapine. Clozapine is a somewhat complicated medication. It's we use it in those individuals that have refractory psychosis or have been through a few other medications and they've those have not worked. In states of inflammation, which could be could occur during a post-operative period, clozapine levels will increase, and this might manifest in sedation, over sedation, and increase things like the risk of aspiration. So this is something where we're commonly seeing patients, and it's not always recognized as a concern. So on our service, a lot of teaching occurs with some of the other specialties, and fortunately we're lucky that we have really good relationships, like services like our surgical with our surgical colleagues and whatnot. So in other times, at other times, we're quite comfortable of home surfaces and surgical surfaces having a go at trying to manage situations. And if they're comfortable with that and need some backup or just a quick call, we're happy to guide folks through different scenarios. At VGH, we feel really lucky. I first met Rebecca on our service. She rotated through the consultation liaison service at VGH. And historically, at least for the past decade, and I think even longer, we've had psychiatry residents come through, but we also have had first year surgical and first year neurology residents come through our service. And this is great. We really enjoy having these off-service residents come through, hopefully they learn something, and we jokingly call it delirium boot camp for the surgical residents. We keep it pretty focused on things like delirium management and management of sedation and related things that would be helpful for a surgeon. In practice, our perspective is surgeons want to operate, and we want to keep them in the operating theater. And if we can impart some things that would help them do that and manage patients on the ward quickly, then and effectively, then we can see it as a good thing. But another really great benefit of it is this. Getting to know us and building up the relationships between services. So Rebecca is no longer with us, and it's been a while, but she has these connections to the psychiatry service, and our hope is that that it's that much easier to consult us, to pick up the phone, and our sense is that, you know, many of the things that happen that are positive in a very large system are relationship based, and a big center can feel small, and in the end, I think that's a positive outcome for the patients. So that's kind of a long winded answer to your question, Chad. Really, I think it speaks into. You know, we're always happy to help our colleagues. That's what we're here for, as a consultation service. And but we're also keen on building capacity in teaching others and teaching people, teaching other folks how to fish and breaking some of those barriers to care, such as through relationship, fostering relationships.
Yeah, I just want to comment, having come from Calgary and having seen the consult psychiatry liaison service, it's really a great service. You know, I think, you know, it's not just the service that we call for when people have suicidal ideation, which is sort of the mental model that I had coming out of residency. You know, really the service has been so helpful in a variety of situations, such as post-operative delirium. And so certainly I've learned a lot from seeing the consult service. See my patients here in fellowship. I think it's time now to really roll into getting a broader discussion on where do we go from here? Where do we take this these results, which I think many of us probably felt intuitively make sense, right? I think we've all had those experiences like Rebecca talked about at the top of the podcast, where we see how mental illness intersects with so many of the outcomes from surgery and in medicine in general. And so I think now is the time to really kind of dig deep on where do we go from here. So Rebecca, you have a great table in the paper, table 2, that kind of outlines some of the potential solutions and strategies for mitigating these negative outcomes. In broad strokes, can you kind of walk us through some of the main strategies that one might propose to help mitigate the inequities in care?
Yeah, so for each theme that arose during our narrative review, we came up with potential solutions to address each of these. So our first theme was access. So how can we better get patients to come to medical services with their surgical illnesses? And we found that part of that would be relationship building and making sure that patients feel comfortable coming to the healthcare system with their concerns. And part of that would be creating a primary care home for these patients where they would be able to have their age-specific screening done, for them to have their mental illness care kind of liaise between their community health, mental health care workers, as well as all of their other medical concerns that may be underlying there, as well as Dr. Sidhu pointed out there, they often have comorbid medical illnesses as well. And treating mental illness like we would for any other type of medical comorbidity. So for our patients, let's say that have diabetes, we want to make sure that their diabetes is optimized before they come into surgery. So making sure these patients' mental illness is optimized in the same way that we'd be monitoring their A1Cs and their glucose preoperatively and postoperatively, we would have that same kind of model for their mental health illnesses as well. And part of that too, in engaging them in their care, is also calling on their social supports, whether that's family or friends, to help them to support this individual throughout their care. And having those family and friends in their social network there, both as allies in their care and both as allies for us to turn to when we need some help or guidance in their loved one's care. And then second would be the outcomes part of the themes that came up in our narrative review. So knowing that these patients are predisposed to worse postoperative outcomes, making sure that the entire surgical team, so residents, staff, nursing, OT, PT, are all aware that these patients are predisposed to that. And so having an education piece around monitoring and providing prophylaxis whenever possible to prevent any negative outcomes that these patients might face in their hospital stay. And because they are, especially in our big tertiary quaternary centers, are very supported in terms of all of the allied healthcare professionals that are available to them. Also using that as a way to engage them back to community and having those types of community supports, both for their surgical concerns, their mental illness concerns, as well as building that primary care base for them to build the rest of their healthcare and future healing from.
Dr. Hamid, I really want to get your insights now as to where we can go with this. You know, it's interesting when we think about, for example, internal medicine and the pre-admission clinic, you know, that it has sort of wavered, right, over the years. I think we had a much lower threshold to send people to the pre-admission clinic to have them optimized for their, you know, various comorbidities. And maybe now we're backing off on some of the testing that we used to do. But clearly in other areas, things are not being well looked after, such as mental illness. So how does this get operationalized for a department of surgery? Like, you know, should everybody be seen by or screened for psychiatric illness prior to getting an operation? Where do you kind of see things going on a cultural and organizational level?
I've been interested in the social determinants of health for a long time. And our groups over the years have done lots of studies measuring problems with access to care or outcomes of care in areas like violence-related injury or multi-system trauma or critical care or acute care surgery. We've measured the risks of having those conditions based on the social determinants of health. And we've also measured access to health systems like trauma systems, for instance, where, you know, we identified that 7 million people in Canada don't have access to or early access to level one or two trauma centers within the golden hour. And when we wrote those studies and published them, it seemed so big and so alarming to measure disparities and to show that these disparities exist, to confirm our feeling that there are disparities, even in Canadian healthcare. But now just measuring it is not enough. Like, after the measurement comes the real hard work of actually changing things. And that's always been daunting and maybe even insurmountable challenge to us. But I think what we're seeing now, and JJ referred to this, is that we're at this moment in history where it's no longer acceptable just to measure disparities without doing something about it. I mean, we have Black Lives Matter and anti-racist movements and the Me Too movement. And what we learn from them is that that's just the first step of a tough struggle to change culture and to actually change experience and reduce disparities. And one of the things I love about Rebecca's approach was exactly that table too, which is, you know, the paper says, here's these, you know, glaring disparities according to mental illness, but here's what the papers say that we can do about it. Things like, you know, multidisciplinary approaches or disposition or studying community-based resources. So that's a start. That's a start. But then, you know, how do you do this? How does a busy surgeon actually, you know, execute on this to actually change the experience, the access, the outcomes of patients? And I think part of it is being sensitive to them and being aware of these problems. But I think the other part is exactly what you said, Amir. It's team building and systems redesign. I think we really have to fundamentally change the way our teams interact and redesign our systems. And that's the way that a busy surgical service can potentially sort of bend the arc of this problem with disparities, and mental illness being one of them. And so in BC, I'm sure you're aware about this, Amir, but the BC Patient Safety and Quality Council has a health matrix for quality. And so, you know, every surgeon cares about quality. The thing is, how do you define quality? And that group defines quality as the normal things that you'd expect, like safety, appropriateness, efficacy, efficiency, things like that. But within that same framework, there's other dimensions of quality, like accessibility, respect, equity. And so if we take an approach to quality that includes things like accessibility, respect, and equity, we're starting to redesign a different kind of health system. And in fact, the American College of Surgeons and the NIH released a statement that without access, there is no quality. Like, how can we even measure the performance of our systems if we're not ensuring that everybody gets access? So it's not a nice to have or a luxury. It is a fundamental, it's a foundation of quality to ensure things like access, respect, and equity. And so in our group, in our division, our health systems redesign has taken the form of something called value-based healthcare, in which what we've done is we've deconstructed our division, at least at VGH and St. Paul's, into 16 small multidisciplinary units. And each unit is charged with creating objectives and key results, and then collecting data to measure performance on those objectives and key results. And we also have in our division, as you know, Amir, you're part of it, the Cultural Safety Committee. And each of our clinical units will be advised by our Cultural Safety Committee about collecting at least one metric on equity, access, social determinants related outcomes. And I think there's something really, there's some potential there. But again, those units will measure these problems, perhaps, and they can draw attention to them. But then how do they actually change them? And, you know, we stalled there for a while, but what we realized is we don't have to do it alone. Every hospital has, you know, physician-led quality improvement programs or team-based quality improvement programs. A lot of hospitals now have diversity, equity, inclusion offices and Aboriginal health teams. So once you create a framework within your group, you can then tap into resources in the environment that will help to provide sort of a more holistic approach to addressing disparities. I don't know if that makes sense, Amir and Chad, but that's kind of the direction of our thinking and what we started to do to try to really take some of these lessons and make a difference with them.
let me divert it. And, you know, it's the question I ask you often, I think, on a lot of different topics over the past couple of years on this podcast. What, how do you get started in an environment where you don't have an informed, motivated, nuanced leader like yourself? Maybe you're in a small town in rural Canada. Maybe you're in Calgary, as you know, as JJ kind of, sort of insinuated, without a psychiatry team available to you. How do you get folks motivated and get folks started? And then also, you know, as I always like to ask you, how do you address the maybe the naysayers who don't see the foundational importance of this topic that surrounds mental illness, as you and as many of our larger surgical societies have now begun to comment on?
In my life, I've been blessed to work with people who, you know, always ask why not, and, you know, let's go, let's do it. And, you know, I include everyone on this podcast in that category. You know, I think optimistically, I think everybody wants to do the right thing. And a lot of people put on their website what they know is the right thing. They have statements about DEI and about Aboriginal health. And so there's a will to make healthcare more equitable. And it is, you could say, it's one of the core principles of Canadian healthcare, or healthcare in general, that, you know, I know in trauma systems and in other surgical systems, identifying vulnerability and caring for it is a fundamental priority. So there's a will to do it. And I think that as grassroots providers, we have to hold people who draft these statements accountable to those statements. And, you know, I used to think that if you take a problem to administration, they'll help you solve it. But what I'm realizing more and more is that you have to come with a pretty finished solution and do it on a shoestring budget. They'll endorse, your hospital leadership will endorse it, most likely because they want to see it done. And then they might find some in-kind resources to help you, or they might link you to other providers with an interest in this area, or you might find some sparks of creativity in the group around you. And I think that's how these team-based quality improvement activities start. You sometimes want to get a grant or, you know, expect a budget for this, but you can do a lot by tapping into the creativity around you and bringing people on board to solve these problems. That's, I guess, kind of a theory, because we're only starting down this pathway, but we've certainly seen, you know, a tremendous amount of support for this, not only in our hospital, but across our health region. I think people respect what physicians and what surgeons say a lot. And if we are passionate advocates, you know, it's very hard for someone to say that that's not an important priority.
Yeah, if I may comment, JJ here, you know, the findings of these study, I think, or studies like this, will resonate with many people. These are big numbers. These are big differences and disparities. Mental health issues being ubiquitous. You know, every family, every person, you know, probably knows somebody who's greatly impacted. And if people are coming to hospital and their outcomes are negative, much more negative compared to the average person, I think my hope is that people are going to pay attention. Just looking at the lifespan of individuals with significant mental illness, it's in the order of 10 to 20 years less than the average Canadian. For me, that number has always been shocking. And that's in a country like Canada. And these kinds of numbers are put in front of people, my hope is that individuals and systems and physicians, regardless department, will galvanize and say, hey, listen, this is something that needs to be addressed. And hopefully lead to some sort of impetus to start some grassroots initiatives in various hospitals. And you know, even those people working in small centers have loved ones that are struggling with mental illness. And regardless of what specialty you're in, you know, I have this perspective, we do well when everyone around us does well. And I mean this from the perspective of different departments and whatnot. So we want, it's something that I think that potentially can gain more momentum the more attention we place on it. And so papers like this that are coming out and now into the surgical realm, hopefully start those discussions.
I'm going to push back a little bit, JJ. I think everyone on this call agrees that this is an important problem. But, you know, I think part of what discussion we're having today and something we've kind of skirted over is a little bit about this stigma around mental illness and maybe even around mental illness among surgeons. I mean, when is the last time any of us, you know, Rebecca, Dr. Hamid, or Dr. Ball have ever talked to, you know, to our colleagues or know colleagues that have acknowledged their own perhaps struggles with mental illness? You know, that's not something that we, particularly in the surgical field, talk about, because, you know, I think we all, to some extent, and again, I'm generalizing here a little bit, but I think to some extent we all pride ourselves on being able to deal with these tough circumstances, both in our training and then having to make decisions in tough situations, both in before, after, and during operations. So, you know, mental illness isn't something necessarily that comes up often in conversation. I will go out on a limb and I'll say that I think it's still stigmatized somewhat in the surgical community, even for surgeons themselves. So what do we do to actually help reduce stigma that surgeons might have towards patients perhaps with mental illness, or even just the concept in general? And maybe JJ, you could comment, I don't know if you have any surgeons as patients, obviously without getting into specifics, but what are some things that maybe we could do, surgeons, attitudes that surgeons have that we could work on to try to reduce that stigma that we have?
Yeah, it certainly is a stereotype. The surgeon, the old school sort of surgeon that's tough as nails and no matter what is going to keep up that persona. But, you know, I see things shifting. I do see things shifting. You know, again, I have that privilege of working with young surgical residents, and the changes that I'm seeing likely mirror what's happening in society at large. Like, one, you know, not that long ago, people were, and this is still the case, were not very comfortable to discuss their mental health issues or challenges. But in this younger cohort of individuals, that dialogue is shifting to the point where people are quite open about their challenges and are actively seeking help, much like they would for any physical condition. And it's really refreshing. On another level, I don't know if our healthcare system is ready for that, given the ubiquitous presence of mental health conditions and the volume that we're anticipating of those seeking care, which really is a good thing, though. In terms of, you know, I did mention before, like half jokingly, that many surgeons that I see would make excellent psychiatrists, and they've all, you know, if you think about when people come to hospital, they're often coming really in the worst periods of their life. Think that nobody's coming to hospital if they don't have to, and certainly not for really positive things. And people are terrified, and people are, you know, people are suffering. They're worried either about their own conditions or their loved ones. And surgeons are at the forefront of that. They're the ones that are interfacing with these individuals and are managing these really tough situations. So, you know, it does feel like that dialogue is shifting. I have colleagues that are that approach me in the hallways. It might be by about their loved ones, but that opens up dialogue, that opens up some discussions, and you get the sense that people are recognizing the importance of managing their own mental health. COVID has been, is really accelerated that discussion. I think it's out in the open how, you know, how COVID has impacted the healthcare system from a mental health perspective, from a quote unquote burnout perspective. And people are savvy to, you know, to that, you know, this is an issue. This is an issue. And if I don't pay attention to it, you know, I might succumb in some way to those concerns. So there is that shift in dialogue that's occurring. There are those that don't want to speak with it and are going to bury it and maybe feel like if they open up that door, things might not look really good and that might lead to some sort of negative follow. You know, my hope is that there are leadership of the respective hospitals and institutions are putting things in place that are making it easy for people to reach out if they can, but it's a challenge for sure.
I think that's beautifully said, JJ. And, you know, in closing, I'd like to thank you and Morad and Rebecca for your time today. You know, it's been a real pleasure. And I think this is a topic that we can only listen to and chat about more and more as time goes on. I'm sure the podcast will be very popular. Rebecca, in terms of closing, I'd like to finish off with you. Amir and I wanted to ask you specifically if you were going to leave our listeners maybe with one or two sentinel thoughts and things to think about on rounds tomorrow or in the operating room tomorrow or in the trauma bay or in the emergency department tomorrow. What would you pass along? And thanks again.
Oh, thank you so much for having us on. I think from doing this review, my biggest take-home points would be in meeting patients with mental illness, wherever that may be in your clinical setting, to meet them where they're at, to listen to their concerns and just take those extra few minutes to listen to how their mental illness is affecting their current presentation of you, and understanding that they may have a history of not having the best healthcare previously due to stigma around their mental illness. And it can be big and brave for them to be coming to you and asking for help and meeting them like you would meet any other patient. We're very lucky as surgeons to meet patients in times of vulnerability when they're really needing help, and using that moment to both reach out to them for whatever surgical reason that they're coming to you, but also in respecting that they have a mental illness and that is going to be a big part of their care, and asking them what you can do to help them with whatever care comes next in their healthcare journey.
You've been listening to Cold Steel, the official podcast of the Canadian Journal of Surgery. If you've liked what you've been listening to, please leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to hear your comments and feedback, so feel free to email us at podcast.cjs@gmail.com or connect with us on Twitter @CanJSurge. Thanks again.